content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Kenny Park Yee for the North Carolina Reading Service.
And this is the November 2023 edition of Education Today. The first article comes from the New York Times, and it's titled, Inside the Pro-Palestinian Group Protesting Across College Campuses. Students for Justice in Palestine, which was founded at Berkeley, has fueled activism and, critics say, intimidation and anti-Semitism. After last month's attack on Israel by Hamas, Students for Justice in Palestine promoted a, quote, toolkit for activists that proclaimed, quote, glory to our resistance. The group has been banned or suspended by Brandeis, Columbia, and George Washington University, and it was recently the target of thundering speeches on Capitol Hill and blistered during a Republican presidential debate. In the 6 weeks since Hamas attacked Israel, there may be no college group that has drawn more scrutiny than Students for Justice in Palestine, perhaps the most popular and divisive campus organization championing the Palestinian cause. But unlike many national campus groups, whether they are sororities, fraternities, religious, or political, Students for Justice in Palestine is by design a loosely connected network of autonomous chapters. There is no national headquarters and no named leader. There is a national student steering committee, but it is anonymous. The group has never registered as a nonprofit, and it has never had to file tax documents. One of the people who founded it about 30 years ago, Hatem Bazian, has described the setup as a symbolic franchise without a franchise fee. That deliberate lack of hierarchy has been crucial to the network's ascent, allowing chapters to spring up with few obstacles, according to interviews with 20 people and a survey of videos, academic writings, archival news accounts, and public records. The network's constellation of tactics and rhetoric, including theatrical demonstrations with apartheid walls and mock Israeli checkpoints, has been replicated on campuses across the country. The flat structure, though, has also fueled worries among pro-Israel groups that accuse the network of driving anti-Semitism on campuses, often with little accountability. A 2016 report from the Cohen Center for Modern Jewish Studies at Brandeis asserted that the presence of a chapter on a campus was, quote, one of the strongest predictors of perceiving a hostile climate toward Israel and Jews. Some critics of the network have gone as far as to raise fears that the student group has illegal financial ties to Hamas, which the U.S. government considers a terrorist organization. But they have not marshaled irrefutable evidence of that, and no prosecutor has ever brought charges against the network. Members acknowledge that their tactics can provoke discomfort, but insist that the group's mission is focused on progressive causes, mainly the plight of Palestinians and combating ills that include white supremacy and anti-Semitism. And they believe that the group's structure is inseparable from its integrity as a student activist movement, which has surged in intensity as the death toll in Gaza, now more than 11,000, according to the authorities there, has increased. Three members of the National Steering Committee said that they had been drawn to the network, which has been closely tied to organizations like Jewish Voice for Peace, because they saw it as a time-tested way to press for sweeping radical change. The committee members, all current or recently graduated students who were interviewed in Washington, spoke on the condition of anonymity because they said they worried for their safety. Some members of the group have had their personal information posted online without their permission. I think this is a moment where my personal feelings don't matter at all, said Carey, a 22-year-old Jewish person from Baltimore and the only steering committee member who agreed to allow part of her name to be published. My priority is showing up for my Palestinian and Arab comrades. And we'll have to cut that article short for time. The next article comes from Education Week, and it's titled, Saturn is a New App for High Schoolers. Here's Why It Has Educators Concerned, by Allison Klein, posted November 16, 2023. The app Saturn bills itself as a time management tool, helping high school students in 17,000 schools keep track of their classes, sports practices, and extracurriculars. But that innocuous-sounding mission hasn't stopped districts around the country, including school districts in 6 Florida counties, Louisiana's West Baton Rouge schools, and Alabama Mobile County schools, from warning parents and caregivers about the platform. The app, which has been growing in popularity, experts say, sparked a spate of news stories about its security flaws in August, after a father's viral Facebook post described how easy it was to get into the app and access significant information about his child's classmates. The company tightened its security procedures in response to those concerns. But experts say flaws in the app's verification process still make it too easy for people, potentially including predators, to pretend to be students at a particular school. Those problems have continued, they say, even though Saturn recently tightened its privacy measures in response to criticism from educators, parents, and experts. On Saturn, students' schedules and social media accounts, including TikTok, Instagram, Snapchat, and Venmo, are visible to anyone on the app who is part of their school community, unless the user specifically opts out. Experts are skeptical most users will take the steps necessary to shield their data. Another red flag, according to experts, is that the app doesn't offer parent or teacher safety controls because it's made solely for students, not for educators, parents, or schools, according to the platform's website. If it's for the purpose of keeping a school schedule all in one place, wouldn't it make sense to connect with schools, said Laura Ordonez, the head of digital content and curation at Common Sense Media, a nonprofit that studies the impact of technology on young people. What's the purpose here? They are coming to the table as a time management, schedule management app, but there's the social media aspect. Are they trying to really be more of a social media app? A spokesperson for Saturn said that students can make their profiles private, which conceals their schedules and social media links to anyone who they don't voluntarily friend on the app. And even if students' schedules are public, they're only available to other students at their school, as determined by the app's verification process, the spokeswoman explained. Our users do visit the preference page, and some make the choice to make their schedule information private, the Saturn spokeswoman said. Users also have the ability to block specific other users from viewing their schedules. But experts aren't convinced that students logging into Saturn would understand that they needed to manually turn those protections on. And they aren't sure it's a great idea for a large number of people, even if they really are just fellow students, to have a breakdown of what classes, sports, and activities individual students go to on a daily or weekly basis, along with social media links. That's potentially dangerous information in the era of school shootings and other safety problems, Ordonez said. You can be mad at someone, and you can know exactly where they are at what time, Ordonez said. Saturn is, quote, supposed to be building community, but high school is a volatile time. We know that there's not only the good things happening in high school, there's the bad, there's the negative, there's the volatile. And we'll have to cut that article short for time. The next article comes from Chalkbeat, and it's titled, The Secret to Good Teaching? Teamwork. Movies about teachers underplay the extent to which a school's success depends on collaboration, by Katharine Friesen, posted November 17, 2023. 12 years ago, when I left a career as a lawyer to become a history teacher, my vision of what a good teacher looked like was shaped in part by movies such as Stand and Deliver, and To Sir with Love, which depict teachers who overcome institutional dysfunction to connect with students and inspire them to achieve their potential. Watching To Sir with Love was even a course requirement in my teacher residency program. It was with great trepidation, knowing that I could not live up to this model but wanting to do my best, that I took my job teaching social studies at a small public high school in the Bronx. I spent the next decade at that same small school, and my time there reshaped my view of what makes a good teacher. The movie model I learned underplays the extent to which a school's success depends on collaboration, and on an interconnected web of complementary skills of teachers and school staff. No one can be all things to all students, yet all students need love and a reason to show up. This requires a team capable of providing academic skills and content, as well as consistency, emotional support, extracurricular activities, and so much more. Who was needed on this team? I expected the obvious. General content teachers, teachers who work with English language learners and students with disabilities, counselors, social workers, paraprofessionals, and other support staff. In practice, I found that what is really needed is staff who can learn from each other and how to support each other. Last year, as I watched my co-teacher quickly diffuse a cranky student with humorous banter, a skill I never did acquire, I appreciated again how much a school needs these different strengths. His action allowed me to calmly steer all the students back to the history lesson at hand, while I benefited from his deep connection with our students. Other teachers learned from my organizational skills, which I used to map out curriculum, break down standards, and track student progress. Schools, I've learned, need teachers who are adept at differentiating instruction for individual learning needs, tutoring small groups, and instructing dozens of students for multiple periods in a single day without a break between classes. They need teachers who know the latest scholarship and those who know the latest social media platforms. They need teachers with physical and mental endurance, but they also need teachers who struggle physically or emotionally. There are lessons that cannot be explicitly taught. They need teachers and staff who can anticipate and prevent conflicts from happening, those who will jump in to contain a fight, those who can calm a classroom after a conflict raises adrenaline and brings everyone close to an emotional edge, and those who can mediate conflict afterward, bringing healing to the whole community. Schools need teachers with high expectations and teachers with a deep personal knowledge of the stresses and life experiences that can make it difficult for children to get to school in the morning and live up to their potential. They need school staff who speak the home languages of the students and teachers who reflect the students' ethnic, religious, and racial backgrounds. They need educators who are willing to reflect on their own assumptions, privileges, and biases, and those who are adept at leading others in that process. They need teachers who are not afraid to have hard conversations with students about class, race, gender, and other challenging subjects, and who know how to create productive spaces for them to occur. And we'll have to cut that article short for time. The next article comes from the Washington Post, and it's titled, What House Republicans Want to Do to Public Education Funding, by Valerie Strauss, posted November 18, 2023. Here's what key House Republicans are proposing to do with federal public education funding for fiscal year 2024. Slash it, especially programs aimed to help students who live in poverty, English language learners, and immigrants and young children. They also want to make sure that not a dime is spent on any lesson connected to critical race theory or to support diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives created by President Biden. The priorities for 2024 education funding were spelled out in H.R. 5894, the biggest domestic funding bill for the Departments of Labor, Education, and Health and Human Services. It was approved this week by a House committee and sent to the full House for consideration, but a planned vote this week was postponed when right-wing Republicans refused to consider more legislation because they were angry that House Speaker Mike Johnson passed a bill with Democratic votes to keep the government open. House Democrats, and possibly some moderate Republicans, will balk at some of the deep education cuts proposed in the legislation, as will the Democratic-led Senate. But the education priorities in the bill show where the Republican leadership stands on federal funding for public education and what they might do if they win control of Congress and the White House in 2024. The Republican legislation would, among other things, cut Education Department funding 28% or by $22.5 billion, cut by 80% or $14.7 billion for Title I, a program which is intended to support schools with high percentages of students who live in poverty, and which is at the heart of the federal K-12 education law called the Every Student Succeeds Act. Critics said this cut, if enacted, could lead to the loss of 220,000 teachers from classrooms serving low-income students. Eliminate funding, $2.2 billion, for state grants that support programs that improve teacher and principal quality. Eliminate funding, $1.2 billion, for federal work study, which provides part-time jobs for students with financial need so they can earn money to help them pay for college. Eliminate funding, $890 million, for a program that supports 5 million English language learners. President Biden has proposed a 2024 budget that seeks to increase Education Department spending by nearly 14%, or $10.8 billion, and boost Title I spending. Democrats blasted the legislation, which also makes cuts in the departments of labor, health and human services, and other related agencies, saying that it, quote, decimates support for children in K-12 elementary schools and early childhood education, and, quote, abandons college students and low-income workers trying to improve their lives through higher education or job training. A coalition of 54 education, civil rights, immigration, and other advocacy organizations wrote a letter to oppose the bill, saying if it were passed as written and became law, it would, quote, devastate America's education system at a time when students are struggling to recover from the COVID pandemic to the detriment of students, educators, families, and the country as a whole. Republicans explained their cuts, at least for K-12 school districts, by saying that they received billions of dollars in federal coronavirus support in recent years and had not spent it all. Reasons that money has not been spent include delayed access to funds, a nationwide shortage of teachers, health professionals, support staff, and others that made it possible to use money targeted for such positions, programs that are designed to be multi-year, and an effort by school districts to make the money last. Most of the money in the first two coronavirus funding bills has been spent. The third, which is by far the largest, required districts to spend at least 20% on academic recovery, but the rest could be used for other efforts to respond to the pandemic. Districts have until September 2024 to commit any unused funding. Representative Robert B. Adderholt, Republican from Alabama, chairman of the Appropriations Subcommittee on Labor, Health, and Human Services and Education, defended the Title I cut on the House floor Tuesday, saying, while Title I grants do support school districts everywhere, including rural schools in districts like my own, these funds disproportionately support big city public schools, the same public schools that failed to educate the most vulnerable children entrusted to them by closing their doors for almost 2 years. Until this funding is drawn down and it is used responsibly, the federal government should not continue to make further investments in these failing schools. The differences in the Democratic and Republican funding proposals reflect differences between Democrats and Republicans about public schooling. The nonpartisan Pew Research Center reported that in June 2022, 72% of Democrats and Democratic-leaning independents viewed public schools as having a positive effect on the country when asked, while 61% of Republicans and those leaning Republican said they were having a negative effect. And we'll have to cut that article short for time. The next article comes from NBC News, and it's titled, Black and Latino Students Lack Access to Certified Teachers and Advanced Classes, Data Shows. About 1% of all students surveyed went to schools where fewer than half the teachers met all state certification requirements. In those schools, 66% of students were Black or Latino. By Michael Robinson Chavez. This was posted November 15, 2023. America's Black and Latino students are at a disadvantage in nearly every measure of educational opportunity, with less access to advanced classes, counselors, and even certified teachers, according to data released Wednesday by the U.S. Education Department. The findings reflect inequities that have lasting implications for students' ability to learn effectively, go on to college, and earn degrees. In America, talent and creativity can come from anywhere, but only if we provide equitable educational opportunities to students everywhere, Education Secretary Miguel Cardona said. The data was released as part of the Civil Rights Data Collection, a federal survey of nearly every public school in the nation. It was gathered during the 2020-2021 school year, when many schools remained at least partially closed for the COVID-19 pandemic. America's education system has long had deep educational disparities. Nearly 7 decades after the Supreme Court ordered schools to desegregate, the new data offers a glimpse of basic differences that endure in schools serving predominantly Black and Latino students. A growing body of evidence has tied instruction from certified teachers to better outcomes from students. But Black and Latino students are more likely to attend schools with lower percentages of certified teachers, according to the new data. About 522,000 students, or about 1% of all students, went to schools where fewer than half the teachers met all state certification requirements. In those schools, 66% of students were Black or Latino. There was a similar divide when it came to school counselors. Overall, 77% of public schools had at least one counselor, and 43% had at least one police officer or security guard. But compared with their white peers, students of color were more likely to be in schools that had security staff, but no counselor. Black students and those of more than one race were 1.2 more likely to attend those schools, while the rate was 1.4 for Native Hawaiian and other Pacific Islanders, American Indians, and Alaska Native students, the Education Department found. Barriers extended to students' access to higher-level classes. Taking advanced classes improves a student's chances of going to college, studies find, but Black and Latino students were far less likely to have access to or enroll in those classes. And we'll have to cut that article short for time. The next article comes from USA Today, and it's titled, Republicans Tried to Squash Biden's New Student Loan Repayment Plan. They Failed, by Zachary Shermeal, posted November 15, 2023. The Senate late Wednesday narrowly struck down a Republican-led effort to overturn President Joe Biden's generous new student loan repayment plan, which conservative critics slammed as a, quote, free college scheme. The Democrat-controlled Senate voted mostly along party lines in a 49-50 vote to stave off the latest challenge to Biden's new income-driven payback option known as Saving on a Valuable Education, or SAVE. West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin, who was openly flirting with a presidential bid after saying he won't seek re-election, was the only Democrat to vote with the GOP. Biden indicated in a memo Tuesday that he would have vetoed the two-step joint resolution anyway, had it passed Congress and arrived at his desk. The plan, which has already enrolled 5.5 million borrowers according to the Education Department, would cap interest for borrowers and base monthly loan repayments on their incomes and family sizes. For some borrowers, payments are set to $0. Education Secretary Miguel Cardona has called it the, quote, most affordable repayment plan ever. Though it failed, the attempt was further proof of the uphill battle Biden faces, be it on the campaign trail, in Congress, or in court, when it comes to just about anything related to forgiving student loans or easing the pinch from payments, one of his top political priorities as he seeks re-election. Senator Bill Cassidy, Republican from Louisiana, introduced the joint resolution on the Senate side in early September with other congressional Republicans. Where is the forgiveness for the guy who didn't go to college but is working to pay off the loan on the truck he takes to work, he said on the Senate floor Wednesday. This is irresponsible. It is deeply unfair. Senate Majority Leader Charles Schumer, Democrat from New York, derided the attempt for sending a cruel message in his words to working families. I'm very glad this chamber had the good sense to defeat it, Schumer said after the measure was declared to have failed to pass. This is a real victory for our young people and for the future of America. Senator Bernie Sanders, independent from Vermont, who as a presidential candidate proposed forgiving the entirety of America's nearly $2 trillion in student loan debt, said although he supports SAVE, Biden's student debt relief plans haven't gone far enough. We have hundreds of thousands of bright young people who have the ability to get a college degree or to get a good trade certificate, but they cannot afford to do so, he said, responding to his Republican colleagues on Wednesday. How absurd is that? And we'll have to cut that article short for time. The final article comes from the Chronicle of Higher Education, and it's titled, Are Public Colleges in Texas Still Allowed to Celebrate Pride Month? Depends Who You Ask, by Adrian Liu, posted November 17, 2023. General counsels at Texas public colleges have outsized power this year to determine which services for historically marginalized students will end when the state's new law restricting diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts in higher education takes effect on January 1. That's because the law, Senate Bill 17, leaves too much to interpretation, critics say. As a result, general counsel's offices will be expected to figure out such details as what to do if job applicants submit unsolicited diversity statements, whether public college employees may serve as faculty advisors for identity-based student organizations, and what kinds of diversity trainings are prohibited. Uneven application of the law could result in disparate experiences for members of historically marginalized groups, depending on which college they attend. A review of guidance documents released by three university systems so far raises questions about whether universities may hold programs to celebrate Pride Month, for example, or whether student health care, such as therapy organized around gender identity or sexual orientation, could be restricted at some campuses. Ishan K. Baba, who co-chairs the education practice at the law firm Jenner and Block and has represented colleges on free speech, Title IX, and antitrust cases, said that while one role of a college lawyer is to protect the institution from liability, another is to help it achieve its goals, academic and otherwise. That means not only looking at case law and challenges to similar laws, for example, but also figuring out a college's risk tolerance, its priorities, and the perspectives of various stakeholders, including the Board of Trustees, President, faculty, staff, students, and the broader community to plan a path forward. In most cases, Baba said, the law is not black or white, but somewhere in between, which means some degree of interpretation is required. You just have to do interpretation sensitive to what your client's ultimate academic priorities are. But differing interpretations of the law could also lead to legal challenges for colleges, experts said. Antonio L. Ingram II is investigating the potential impact of Senate Bill 17 on communities of color and the LGBTQIA+ community in Texas as an assistant counsel for the Legal Defense Fund, a racial justice advocacy organization. He said that in general, a law may be considered unconstitutionally vague by courts if it fails to provide people of ordinary intelligence a reasonable opportunity to understand what conduct it prohibits. And we'll have to cut that article short for time.
We've run out of time for this episode of Education Today. Please be sure to tune in next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Kenny Park Yee for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Education Today is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.